Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is Hidden Killers Half Year in Review. A look back at some of the most compelling cases of 2026 so far. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
In October of 2020, Eric Richards sat down with an estate planning attorney and said something that should stop you cold. He said he needed to protect himself and his three children from his own wife. That's a fun conversation to have. Protect himself and his children from his own wife, not from a stranger, not from a business dispute, from the woman he married. He used the words recently discovered in ongoing abuse and misuse of finances. He had those words written into a legal document. The following month, he executed a trust, put his sister in charge of his assets, structured his estate to intentionally exclude Corey, and did it all without telling her. That happened a year and a half before he was found dead. A jury has now found Corey Richens guilty of taking his life. So before we go further, this, I want you to let you know, of course, it's commentary. This is my opinion, built on what is documented in records, charging documents, forensic accounting testimony, civil filings, and what 12 jurors in Summit County just decided beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm calling it like I see it. And what I see is a pattern I've covered in true crime for years. It has a name. And this case is one of the clearest examples of it I've ever encountered. As we go through this, I want you to give me your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching to this or watching this right now. The defense wanted you to feel something for Corey Richens. That's the goal of any defense. Feel something for our client. She's not a monster. She's a human being. So they attempt to pitch you a story. And this is a story that's filled with contradictions because over here they're saying this is a woman trapped in a marriage to a man who didn't believe in her, overlooked, financially dismissed, so sidelined by her own husband that she had no choice but to secretly build something of her own. And look, that is a real scenario for a lot of people. That does exist, just not here. And it's important for us to be able to look at the situation and go, yeah, you know, she claims this, but don't take her at her word. What does the evidence actually show? Oh, nothing of this? Nothing of this claim? And that's an important thing. And it's scary because a lot of people will just go right to that, right to the victim who claims victimhood and go, oh, you're a victim. You tell you're a victim, you must be a victim. A lot of victims in this world, by the way, are not victims. At all. Be aware of that little factoid. It's because someone claims it doesn't mean it is. It's up to you to make those determinations, to take a look at the facts and go, are you telling the truth? Because there's this little thing that human beings do. They lie a lot for their own self-interest and hope you don't notice. This is one of those cases. In a recorded phone call made after Eric's death, she told his best friend that Eric never gave me a chance because he didn't believe in me. That was the story. For just a short second, Corey, did you ever consider maybe there's a reason no one believes in you? Maybe there's a reason your own husband didn't believe in you? Maybe you have a track record of not being a believable human being. Maybe someone just shouldn't believe in you because you exist. There's a thought. So that was the story. The jury did not buy it. And here's why, because we can actually look at what she built. The moment you put the documented financial record next to her narrative about it, the victim story doesn't just fall apart, it inverts entirely. And that inversion is worth examining in detail because, in my opinion, what the records show isn't a woman who was trapped. It's a woman who decided that someone else's success was hers to take and then systematically took it. And when anybody looked at her in a way of, oh, could I possibly be viewed as victim? Could I? Then the story is slightly different to that person because it invites empathy, it invites sympathy from an outside source, which she feeds on like a fucking vampire. Eric Richens came into this marriage with something real. He built CNE Stonemasonry with his own hands, owned his own home before they ever met, and had the kind of financial foundation that comes from years of actual work, not just pretending you're Joanna Gaines because you watch a lot of HGTV and like flipping houses and shiplap with other people's money. Work. Yeah, you don't just get to attach your ass to it and say, that's mine because of proximity. No, that's not how that shit works. They met in 2009 when she was working as a cashier at the Home Depot. Yeah. They had a child in 2012, married in 2013, and signed a prenuptial agreement that protected both of them. The prenup is the fulcrum of everything that followed. And it's what a lot of people like to look at and go, see, he's not being fair. He's being cruel. He's protecting his assets from a vicious, narcissistic bitch. Hoping to God that it never comes to that, that this woman he's marrying doesn't actually turn into that until she does. But he knows the vipers are out there and he knows he has something they want. He's hoping that she wants him not for that, but just in case, he's going to cover his ass because he's smart and he's responsible, something she carries neither quality of. If she left Eric, she walked away with nothing from his pre-existing assets. But if Eric died while they were still married, she stood to inherit everything, including his businesses. Hold that. In 2019, according to the evidence presented at trial, Corey used Eric's power of attorney, access he had trusted her with, to secretly take out a $250,000 home equity line of credit on his premarital home without his knowledge, without his permission. She used that money to launch K. Richens Realty. Oh, she's so starved. She has no control over money. So she has to go steal it from her husband, literally. Or, I don't know, find gainful employment and plot your own way in life like your husband did, like most of us do. We don't just take from others as handouts. There's a frickin' thought. But for some, that modality, it's just too much work. They'd rather just take all the glory and have none of the actual grit from doing the hard work to get there. The defense framed this as a woman taking initiative because her husband wouldn't support her. Yeah, taking initiative to steal $250,000 from him without telling. What initiative that is. If this were the other way around, oh my God. If the husband were stealing $250,000 from the wife, wow. What an evil man he would be. But in this case, oh, she's trapped. No, she's telling you she's not. She's telling you that. That's the narrative she wants you to believe because we're all too eager to believe any victimhood statement that any unsuspecting, innocent-looking person says aloud without actually doing our homework and looking into the facts of the case and the person behind the claims. What that framing required you to ignore is this. Eric gave her power of attorney. It's not the act of a financially controlling man. That's the act of a man who trusted his wife to access his most significant asset. And she used that trust to put his house on a line without asking him. A house he earned. A house he built with his own money. His own hard work and struggles. Before Corey ever existed. And what did she do? She showed up and she took. told him she'd pay it back soon. Then she led him to believe that she had. She never did. This is the first data point in the pattern, and the pattern is consistent. Identify someone who trusts you, access what they have, take it, deny it, promise to fix it, and keep going, and keep telling yourself you deserve it because you exist, because you're his wife, and that just must entitle you to anything and everything that he has. Because he is unfortunately dumb enough to pick up the cashier at the Home Depot. So what did she build with that money? Well, in its first year, K. Richens Realty handled one project. By 2021, it was attempting to manage 15 simultaneous renovations with no history or experience in that world. That's not scaling a business. That's what spinning out looks like. In one documented email to a creditor, according to trial testimony, she described herself as the head of a company with over 100 employees who had made more than $1 million on her last five deals combined. None of that was true. According to forensic accountant testimony, in the 5 months before Eric died, the business brought in $170,000 in revenue, while its monthly debt obligations exceeded $250,000. By the time he died, she was approximately $7.5 million in debt, paying $80,000 a month to lenders, bouncing over $300,000 in checks to contractors, and had borrowed from more than 25 lenders to keep the whole thing from visibly collapsing. The forensic accountant called it imploding. In December of 21, she contracted to purchase what was called the Midway Mansion. That's the big unfinished property for $2.9 million in high interest debt due in 6 months, despite having no financial ability to actually service it, refinance it, or sell it. Eric Richens wasn't wrong about his wife's business instincts. He was exactly right. And here's the thing about that, the narcissist response to being accurately assessed is never to examine whether the assessment is correct. It's to make the person who assessed you the problem. What she called his lack of belief in her was just his ability to see what was directly in front of him. And when he saw it, she didn't stop. She kept going and made him the villain for noticing. When Kay Richens Realty was imploding, Corey Richens was living a different story entirely. She'd been carrying on a years-long affair with a man named Josh Grossman. She bought him two trucks. She gave him money when she felt like it. She was texting him about a future together, about the Midway Mansion, about raising kids there, about the life she was building in her head while the one she was living was financially disintegrating around her. She wasn't trapped. She wasn't financially sidelined. She was funding another man's life with money she was allegedly stealing from her husband's while she employed the other man and coercively controlled his existence. Who's trapped now? Who's the one coercively controlling another human being in this story? Not providing a paycheck to the person she employs, basically paying him in sex and trucks and whatever she feels. So you can stay in the houses we're rehabbing as I just completely siphon money from my husband and then bleed it everywhere I go. But I really need you to work for me for next to free because I can't afford to pay anybody. So I know what I can give you. Wink, wink. If this were the other way around, if this were a man doing this to a woman, every woman would be freaking the fuck out. Because this is coercive control to the nth degree. This is like R. Kelly type shit. Except instead of the music industry, it's the housing industry. Instead of MTV, it's HGTV. And the roles and the scripts are flipped. Think about that framing for a moment. The trapped narrative requires you to believe that Eric controlled the money so tightly that Corey had no financial independence. But she was buying trucks for her boyfriend. She was wiring tens of thousands of dollars to contractors. She was managing 15 properties, quote unquote, simultaneously. The money was moving. She just wasn't the one generating it. And it wasn't only Eric and Grossman. In the blast radius, in January 22, according to charging documents, she took $45,000 from a close personal friend, wired as a down payment for the property deal Corey was brokering. The money hit her account and was immediately redirected to an outstanding debt. The deal never closed. The friend was eventually evicted from the property, and there are real estate buyers who sued her, alleging she stole from them. That she sold them a home with hazardous mold levels that she knew about before the sale. So you got that little ditty going on the side. I forgot about that. I mean, this is just, it's a little side note to all the other chaos. She's selling homes laden with mold. Gotta keep that money going. Text messages showed her realtor warned her the basement bedroom was super moldy before listing. The home was presented to buyers as pristine. One of them told Dateline, "We're just innocent bystanders in her path of destruction. You and a gazillion other people." Beginning in July of 21, according to prosecutors, she submitted altered bank documents using Eric's masonry business financials to fraudulently secure mortgage loans she wouldn't otherwise have qualified for. She was using her husband's financial identity to borrow money he didn't know about to prop up a business he didn't know was failing to maintain a facade that existed only in the story she was telling everyone around her. Oh, how controlled she is. The people in the blast radius of this alleged pattern weren't faceless institutions. They were her husband, her closest friend, her clients, her contractors. Every person who trusted her ended up worse for it. That's not a streak of bad luck. That is, in my opinion, a way of operating. Oh, all this while she's raising three kids, which we never really hear much about because they're far from a primary thought in the world of Corey Richens. Here's a moment that, in my opinion, cuts through everything else. 2 months before Eric died, according to prosecutors, Corey logged into the account for his business life insurance policy, a $2 million buy-sell agreement tied to CNE Stonemasonry, and attempted to make herself the beneficiary. The insurance company caught it. They notified Eric and his business partner. She was then removed from the policy. 2 months later, Eric was dead. This is not a woman who was trapped and reactive. And look, even if she was, let's say this is a totally different scenario. Let's say Eric really was tight with the purse strings. Let's say he didn't let her have a dime or kept her in a very short leash. Of, okay, here's how much money I'm going to allow you to spend because you have a horrible record of spending money and making poor decisions. Let's say that that was even the case. How on earth does it ever then justify stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars, fraudulently going to banks with bogus documents, stealing from your best friend her life savings, and essentially zeroing out Eric, the millions of dollars that he had worked his life for to make, to secure for his kids and his family? How is that in any way, shape, or form ever going to be justified in anyone's mind out there who's going, see, he was tied on the purse strings. Oh, so that gives her then permission to go steal hundreds of thousands of dollars from the husband just because? A lot of people will sit there and just, anyone who's sitting there thinking that is the type of person who would go do that. You're going to do this to me? Well, I'll show you. Well, great. I love your fourth grade level of thinking. It'll work out great for you in prison. This is not a woman who was trapped and reactive. This is a woman who was planning. And when that plan got interrupted by an insurance company with functional oversight, she didn't stop. According to prosecutors, she just went in a different direction. When Eric died, the plan fell apart in a way she apparently didn't anticipate because she's an idiot. Corey Richens allegedly believed she would inherit Eric's estate, the money, the business, all of it, which she didn't know, what Eric had deliberately kept from her. was that the trust he'd executed in November of 2020 had already moved his assets out of her reach. His sister was a trustee. His estate was structured specifically to exclude her from controlling it because he knew she was capable of this sort of shit. She'd been removed from the life insurance. She didn't know about the trust. She thought she'd get everything. According to prosecutors, she poisoned him for money she didn't even know she wasn't going to get. I guess the lesson here, folks, is if you have to change these things because you don't trust your partner, number one, don't stay with that partner. But number two, let them know. Let them know so they don't decide to go down the road of murder only to be surprised later that they get nothing of it. It might discourage them from doing that. Not to blame a dead guy, but, you know, transparency might be the best answer. When she's not being, be as bright and transparent as you can be. Oh, why are you no longer going to be the trustee on all of these things? Well, because you have a track record of stealing $250,000 from me. That might be why I don't trust you with money. That might be why I don't trust you with my safety, my well-being, the future, the financial stability for myself, for our children, which you seem to care nothing about other than your ego and making it look like you're some sort of HGTV success story when you are the exact opposite of all of it, hemorrhaging money left and right. But she did get something. What she did receive was $1.4 million in life insurance money that, according to forensic accounting testimony, was gone almost immediately. Wow. $1.4 million? You get that and it's gone like that? How does that happen? Well, it's absorbed by the debt she spent years building. Eric's family has filed a $13 million civil lawsuit against her. The Midway mansion she dreamed about was foreclosed on and sold after her arrest. And then there's what she did after he died. She then published the children's book, Are You With Me? Featuring a father with angel wings watching over his son. It was written, according to testimony at trial, by a ghostwriting service that she hired. She pitched it to a local morning show weeks after his death. She promoted it publicly. She constructed a narrative of a devoted, grieving mother around a book that she didn't write about a man prosecutors say she poisoned. She went on TV to suck up the empathy, to suck up the sympathy that's actually designed for her children who lost their father. She needed some more of that, being the little vampire that she is. This is where the pattern becomes impossible to ignore, because the book isn't just bad optics. In my opinion, it's the tell. The narcissist doesn't grieve. They perform grief. They manage the story. They cast themselves in the role of devastated widow and make sure the audience is watching. The grief book wasn't for her kids. It was for her. If it were for her kids, she would have written it herself. It was for everyone else. It was narrative management. It was the story she needed people to believe while investigators were quietly building the case that would eventually convict her. Her own mother sent a copy of it to the investigators anonymously through Amazon with a little gift note saying, "This is the real Corey. There's two sides to every story." You're damn right there is. Let's talk about that 2006 story about your partner who died of an opioid overdose while she was not necessarily actively, she wasn't actively using anymore. She apparently was good. And she's just dead. Overdose. I mean, it happens. When you're surrounding yourself with people that are actively using, and you do this for a good portion of your life, the odds of you encountering more than one person that overdoses is significantly high. I'm going to give her that. 1,000%. And look, I'm in no way saying that Corey's mother killed her partner years ago. That's not at all what I'm saying. I'm saying it's odd. I'm saying it's odd that you have two people that close to you in your life that died of, according to Corey, she didn't realize it was fentanyl. She thought it was something else. But two people in your life that die of an overdose like this, it's a little weird. It raises an eyebrow. It deserves a little investigative work. Just to be sure. Now, I know she's not been charged with anything, not convicted of anything, nothing. And I'm not saying she did anything. I'm just saying it feels a little weird. it feels a little odd. But again, probably absolutely nothing. Her attorney says it's crazy. Anyone who would think differently, nah, it's not that. It's just, it's a tragedy. And it might be. But you, yeah, you're pretty close to your daughter. You know that somebody died this method a while back. I'd really love to see those text messages, and I'm hoping they did. The investigation was really shit in this case. One of those rare cases where the investigation is absolutely horrible over in this lane, but the evidence is so damning. She's so stupid on the way that she handled everything that even when you have bad police work and an absolute shit investigation, she still managed to dig her hole deep enough. That's how powerful of a narcissist that she actually is. She's able to go that deep despite this, despite things that in many other ways could have been looked at as reasonable doubt. There's some weirdness. A family track record, a family history of another person that died. I'm just saying, it's weird. In no way, shape, or form am I saying, though, that her mother had anything to do with this whatsoever. I would just love to see the text messages and the communications between Corey and her mom leading up to the death. Emails, anything, anything. I'd love to see that. And hopefully, there's absolutely nothing there. It's just, who likes hush puppies? Do you like Moscow Mules, Mom? I like Moscow Mules. What sort of omelet should I drop off at Eric's car with a sandwich? You know, conversations like that. I'm sure there's nothing weird in them at all. I don't know, though. I've never seen them. I don't know that any that wasn't brought up into this case. Again, not saying anything like that. Just saying it's weird. And we should be aware. And when she was arrested and sitting in jail, she allegedly wrote that 6-page letter to her mother, recovered by investigators, and entered into evidence at trial that appeared to script what she wanted family members to say about Eric's history with drugs. Prosecutors called it witness coaching. She called it fiction that she was working on. So she's writing this letter to Mom. Here's how we got to tell the story. So Corey, in her mind, at least, believes that her mom, if she were to receive this letter and it wouldn't get caught by authorities investigating her jail cell, in Corey's mind, at least, and we have no idea how her mom would have taken this, her mom might have said, Corey, this is horrible. We don't lie. Bad girl. We don't do that. Asking me to fix your story and have your brother lie for you and me tell a fictitious story. You know us. We're better than that, Corey. You think that's how it would have went down? Maybe. I don't know. I can't honestly say. I have no clue. I would hope so if the letter actually had made it to her mom that would have been the reaction. But I really don't know. Neither do you. No one really would. It never happened. But think about that. What it takes to do that. You're in jail. Your husband is dead. A jury is being assembled to decide if you killed him. And your response is to write a 6-page document directing the people around you on what to say and how to say it. The story still has to be managed. The narrative still has to be controlled, even from a jail cell, because narcissism knows no bounds. You can't trap it in a jail cell. It'll just leak out. Skeletor will stay there in the jail cell, but the ideas of Corey Skeletor will leak out. I don't know why I called her Skeletor, but that is not the behavior of someone who knows they're innocent and trusts the process. That is the behavior of someone who has spent years operating this way and doesn't know how to stop. So when Corey Richens, crying into a phone, told Eric's best friend that he never believed in her, I want you to sit with what that complaint actually means. A man allegedly watched his finances drained, his house put up as collateral without his knowledge, his business documents falsified, his insurance redirected, his trust exploited by the person He gave that trust to a man who documented all of it with an estate planning attorney, rearranged his estate to protect his children from their mother, and then went home without saying a word publicly, who stayed in the marriage. And the grievance, the thing she wanted you to feel sorry about, was that he didn't fully believe in her business. That's the grievance. He didn't believe in me. Yeah. No shit. Anyone with any level of common sense would not believe in you, Corey Richens. There's nothing to believe in. This is the move. When the walls start closing in and the documented record starts speaking, you become the victim. You take the person who saw through you and reframe their clarity as cruelty. And you take their self-protection and call it control. You take their completely justified wariness and dress it up as a character flaw. You vilify the people who caught you. You make their accuracy about you into an indictment of them. The performance is loudest from the people who have done the most damage. The more undeniable the record, the more essential the victim narrative becomes. It didn't work on 12 people in Summit County in that jury box who spent 3 weeks looking at the full picture. Eric Richens documented what he believed was happening quietly, legally, without drama. He was trying to make sure his kids would be okay. He already knew exactly what he was dealing with. The jury just confirmed it. Give me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. You're like, damn, you really got into this one. You're right, I did. I lived it. I survived. This shit's real. These people are real. These sort of personalities, these modalities of human beings are real. They don't just happen to somebody else on Dateline or on this show or wherever you're watching a true crime horror story of the gazillions of people who have this modality and the desire to act in this sort of way. They are all too friggin' real. And if you recognize it and if you see it, take it like a tornado warning. Seek shelter. Get out of its way. You're not going to stop the tornado. You're not going to fix the tornado. Get out of its way. And then do whatever you can to change that environment so that storm of a human being doesn't have the energy to keep twisting away and destroying everything around you. But that's on you. If you recognize it, if you see this around you, it's not up to anybody else to stop it. It is up to you. Or you will risk becoming Eric Richens. It is true. When they are exposed, when everything comes down to the end, and all of their shame, all of their lies, all of their bullshit that they've been spewing to you and making you and others believe for so long, when they're confronted with it, when the exposure comes, when the mask slips, that's the most dangerous, scary point you can possibly be in a relationship with a borderline or a narcissist like Corey Richens. Again, I can't diagnose her. That's my opinion. That's when shit can really hit the fan. Some of us dodge the bullets. Some succumb. If you've yet to see that bullet come your way, figuratively or literally, you still have time. Do something about it. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you get podcasts so you don't miss any of our commentary, our reporting, and our discussions on these cases. We do greatly appreciate it. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
The defense called zero witnesses. They put nothing on other than, obviously, on cross. They bet the prosecution hadn't proved their case, and they lost. But they did land some real hits along the way. What worked, what didn't, and what does the verdict tell us about where this all fell apart? Bob Mata is with us, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, and Robin Drake is always with us. Bob, with the defense of Corey Richens, I want to talk about some things that came in that may have looked, I don't know, maybe strong for Corey at the beginning. If we're to look at her as being completely innocent, have nothing to do with this. This is just a mother. She's trying to help her kids grieve. She's trying to grieve. One of the ways she expressed it was through writing a children's book about grief. Okay, this is an interesting exercise. And if done from a pure standpoint and this actually happened and you didn't kill your husband, okay, that's a creative way of dealing with this. And then we found out she got it ghostwritten. She didn't participate in the actual writing of the damn book. How damning was that little nugget that put some more context around the book to Corey in this trial, do you think? Because it really took that whole concept away of, well, maybe this was what she was doing. It was pretty much proven it wasn't.
Yeah, I think that fact, even though I don't know the relevance in mm-hmm. like that much because it was after the fact. And
yeah,
I don't think they put anything on to show that was certainly one of her actual motives. Like, mm-hmm. There's no part of me that thinks that Corey Richens did this in order for her to be able to write this book. You know,
but I'm just saying it wasn't written by her.
I understand. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. But what I'm talking about is relevance.
Right. Sure. Okay.
To a murder charge. So, you know, and like, I think if you were to ask most attorneys, they'd be like, yeah, I'm having a hard time figuring out the relevance. And I think that ghostwriter aspect hurt more than the right, you know, the fact that the book existed at all. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I like that did more damage with the jury because it showed her as being a fraud when it shouldn't be that way. I think if you asked most high-end authors, they've all used a ghostwriter at some point.
Sure.
You know, I mean, ghostwriters exist for a reason, especially if you have a name and if you have writer's block and you're like, look, man, I need a little help on that. You know, like this thing is different, though, you know,
and it was also because what it did was it again, the relevance, I don't know either. But it gave that data point also of just another example of insincerity, lack of transparency, because you're saying one thing on these news broadcasts as if it wasn't. And it wasn't. The other thing, I mean, because I always start with numbers, stats, averages. And I looked it up earlier on, was this is the first time I could find an example of a grieving spouse that lost their, you know, that lost someone to death, wrote a book about it for their kids. So it became such a deviation from a norm already that it attracted that attention. So I really wonder, had she not written this, you know, what would have happened? And the dog letter was actually the one that you're saying has sealed it. But I'm also curious, you know, kind of going back now from the reverse optic on these closings, what do you think? Because you know, I like making a sausage, understand what's going on behind the scenes. When prosecution got up there and gave that, basically, here's how you fill out your form of guilty with the first statute. Here's the here's what we're doing to prove this statute, this statute, this statute. Yeah. I know defense already had their closings in their head. Do you think there's an aw shit moment when they're watching this? Do they retool on the fly, or are they going to stick with what they have?
Well, I think that they're going to probably stick with what they have. I mean, typically what you do in terms of your theory, you're going to stick with what you have because you craft a closing argument over months. Right. You know what I'm saying? This isn't something that she just threw together that night. Like, you know what your issues are going into trial. You know what your biggest bad facts are that you have to try to address. And, you know, the biggest amount of tailoring that I think took place for Lewis in drafting that thing was the fact that they elected not to put on the defense. That changes things. you know, because you're shifting from kind of leaning into what you may have presented had you put on a case to really leaning into the burden and the fact that this investigation was awful. And it was, you know, and it's one of those things where, so she's having to tailor it a bit to that. And then you're always going to try to incorporate, because they only get one bite at the apple, as we saw yesterday. The state gets two bites. They have the burden. So they start, and then the defense goes, and then the state ends with their rebuttal closing. So you want to try to address some of the things that are brought up. Those are, that's where you're just doing it on the fly, because you obviously, you have an idea of what they're going to say, but you don't know how they're going to phrase it. You don't know how they're going to put it out there to the jury in terms of the impact that it may have, where you're like, oh, that's something I'm going to have to deal with because that was powerful. You know what I'm saying? So like those kind of issues arise during the state's closing where you're like, I have to address them. But, the, you know, the bulk of it is going to be just what, you know, you think is going to get that jury to that place where you're like, all right, I've got a firm understanding of what beyond a reasonable doubt is. And as much as I think that this woman did it, which I think everybody on that jury did, and obviously, you know, by the conviction. But, you know, if I were to put the screws to people that were on that jury and you know, really kind of challenge them a bit, I bet you we'd have some pretty thought-provoking, provocative question or question and answer sessions, because it's just they didn't deliberate. Like the entire purpose of deliberating is to challenge it. I mean, I encourage everybody to go back and watch the original 12 Angry Men, man, because it's a perfect example of what needs to take place in that jury box. Like in that movie, every dude walked back there like, this is like, let's just give me the form. This guy clearly did it, because the facts laid out in such a way that it appeared that the guy did it. And ultimately you have Henry Fonda just playing devil's advocate, just throwing some ponderables out there. And the ponderables start a dialogue, because we cannot get to the point, and this goes to what you were saying earlier, T, about, you know, have we just become accustomed to these kinds of monsters that so now we're able to recognize it? Nah, man, that can't be the way we try cases in this country.
Well, I'm not saying it should be, but I'm saying, are we, is that what we're doing?
Maybe. I don't like it.
I'm just saying, is that what's happening in some of these?
I don't know, because we are seeing these faster verdicts in cases that were pretty complex. I mean, Adelson's were both done in like 2 hours.
Yeah.
Murdoch was done in 3.
And I just wonder, I mean, in my opinion, I feel like we have a narcissistic epidemic going on in our world, in our country at the very least. And I just wonder if we're just all getting so damn accustomed to these folks, and we're just, people who've been affected by them are so affected by them that it is just, you get a whiff of it and you're like, fuck that. You know, I mean, and I'm not saying that that's how it should be. You really do need to examine everybody. Everybody's different. But I just wonder if it's like, I got stung, you know, it's just the natural human reaction. You get stung by something so hard and you get traumatized by it, you're going to be that much more averse to it, you know, when it's presented to you.
It's an interesting observation, Tony, because one of the things that we've said numerous times, actually I haven't said it for this case, but we've said a lot of on the other cases, especially when we start dealing with age groups, that a lot of the cases that we're seeing that are doing horrendous things similar to this, not the same modality, obviously, but like taking advantage and taking someone's life or doing serious bodily injury, it's because they're escalating in chaos and they have zero problem solving skills. And they go from big problem, I'll kill them. Big problem, life insurance, kill them. And we keep seeing that pattern coming out. And I when we're talking about arcs of society, you know, when you're talking about that arc of narcissism, it's, I think part of that without the diagnoses, because we can't, is actually as a society, our problem solving skill has really bottomed out comparatively, I think.
Well, thank God for AI.
Yeah, right.
True.
Well, at least it helps with research.
Yeah. That's absolutely true, man. You know, I think there's a lot of truth. And as far as the narcissism goes, it's overused.
Yeah,
like there's like it's an abused word at this point.
I agree.
And that is not to say that there are not millions of narcissists out there, because there are. But like everybody's not a narcissist. Some
people
are just selfish assholes, and they're not necessarily they wouldn't be clinically diagnosed as.
Well, I mean, here's my take on some of that.
They're
nutters. I think for the longest time of life, we've called them other things. We've called them selfish assholes, a dick, a bitch, or whatever. Insert something here. And then that's just kind of where it was at. Yeah, so-and-so were there. Yeah, they're kind of, you know, I get along with them, but they're kind of this or that. I just feel like maybe we're using the correct term finally, and not just we're using a more clinical term and not such a derogatory, a vile way of explaining someone away. And maybe that's why it feels like it's being used more, and we're just using less of the, you know.
Yeah,
terms.
I mean, maybe,
I don't know,
but it is a clinical thing, though. You know what I mean?
It is, but I think they've all been clinical for all these years. We're just finally recognizing this. Going, it's more than just someone being an asshole. This is how their brain works, and it's fucked up. These cognitive distortions that these people live with and act on are very real. I don't think Corey necessarily is sitting there with a cauldron plotting like a witch. I think. This is just her modality. This is how she functions.
I actually side with Bob on this one, though, only because of the clinical word of it, Tony, because we covered it on yesterday's show, too. I was.
You mean I actually side with Bob on this one?
Well, because you defense Bob. I don't go on you. You know, I'm a behavior guy, and you don't like behaviors.
What a compliment that was.
I got to caveat my support of Bob, right? No, but I think Bob's right on this one, the overuse of it, because we've desensitized ourselves for the use of it. And I think, Bob, you've probably been exposed to this too. When you work with a lot of psychologists and clinicians, I got slapped around hard by ours on our behavior team. If one of us would use one of those, they would call them a term of art, and you could not use a term of art and assume anything of a clinical nature towards someone. So even on our show, I'm always refraining from using it, always caveating it if we do throw it around, because it is that term of art that is... It gets misused because it's a very specific set of criteria that got to be met in the DSM.
Well, there's of course narcissistic traits, and then there's the disorder. I mean, and you gotta check so many boxes here in the DSM to actually get to the disorder. We all have narcissistic traits, and I think very quickly many of us, the second someone just displays a narcissistic trait, they're a narcissist. No, we all have things,
right.
but if you check enough boxes over here, and I think Corey would be one of them, once you really get to know someone or study. And go, yeah, they check the fucking box.
See, and I think Corey's more a blend of she's a sociopath. Like,
I think she's in the, it's all part of the dark triad, you know.
Thick soup.
She is a real thick slog of stew of all kinds of different mental illness type things. And she is one of those people that ultimately at the end of the day. You know, because I always sit there and I always try to get into these people's heads, you know, because I always think about the quiet moments in these people's lives when these people that were watching these trials and were like, wow, man, it's like the amount of thought that had to have gone into that. And I'm talking about in those quiet moments in our life, like where, you know, My thinking chamber is my shower. I do a lot of critical thinking in my shower because it's the one place where nobody's bugging me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, I'm in there, not to say that my wife or my kids bug me, but it's just one place where I have, you know, that time and that space for myself where I could just think uninterrupted without this thing, with nothing. You know what I mean? So, but in those quiet moments, and I try to delve into like, what must this person be thinking? Because at some point, if you're going to do something like this, it has to have become obsessive, you know, like where she's trying to resurrect this flailing business. And at some point she shifts to this concept, like, all right, I got to get to the money. This guy's blocking me from the money. The only thing that's going to save this business, because that's what I care most about, more than my children, more than anything else. It's like that was that thing that I really liked that Bloodwork did. And it wasn't the kind of misogynistic aspect of him saying that she was intensely ambitious. That's a shitty thing to say, because if it were men, you know, you wouldn't be saying somebody is intensely ambitious as a derogatory sense. You'd be like, wow, that's a really ambitious guy. Go get him, pal. But I took a little bit of exception on behalf of women, and women in the chat, you let me know if I'm off on this. I thought that was kind of a shitty way to term it, but the overarching theme was right. Like, yeah. like all she cared about was her business. And I think that, like I said, that took precedent over the kids. It took precedent over her husband, obviously. Took precedent over her family. Everything fell to the white side. And it was all about how she was perceived by the public. She was that, she was that person that had to keep up with the Joneses, you know.
And that's the behavior of the unhealthy that everyone kept seeing in that arc, was that every action she was taking, the only consequences of the action she was playing out in those quiet moments was the impact it was having on her. She wasn't playing it out on the impact of her husband, not playing out the impact of her kids, not playing out an impact of anyone else in her circle, because every time she did something, it was having a negative impact on them. But it was being ignored by her because it's causing chaos in her life. So she kept doubling down. She's a dog locked onto that chew toy, and she wasn't letting go, thinking, you know, it's like she kept losing on black on the roulette table, but kept doubling down on black every single time, thinking it was going to work the next time, and it just never did. But she was, but she wasn't thinking about the fact that the money she's put on black was coming from everyone else. And she was just robbing, and it just got in that OODA loop of hers.
I want to bring another kind of a flip the script type thing, like we were just doing there. We were talking about how Bloodworth, we were saying the way he was saying, you know, the ambition. But another thing that came to my mind in this case was the boyfriend, and how this would have. I mean, it played off pretty deplorable in this case. It just, the way she used him, I mean, it was like, gosh, that's really icky. That's really shitty. But had this been the other way around, I mean, if Corey was a man and the boy and her boyfriend, you know, was a woman, and this was a guy who brought in this woman who's really into, you know, home reno stuff, not gonna pay her. I'll pay you when I can or whatever I feel like. Let me buy you some stuff. Let me pretty much, you know, when you need something, I'm going to sleep with you. That'd be looked at as like R. Kelly type shit in terms of like coercive control you're bringing in. Instead of like the music industry, it's the HGTV industry. Yeah. I mean, except in the roles were reversed, it would be looked at horrendous. I think that would have ended the case right there if it had been reversed. You mean you're a guy and you brought this woman in to coercively control her and use her for sex as she renos your homes and you pay her whatever you feel like whenever you pay her? Holy shit. Like, that's horrible.
You thought that was a fast deliberation? Think about that. If those genders had been reversed, oh my God. Like if that was a dude on trial, not Corey Richens.
You did that to a woman. And it's not even about him, but it's just, it's the character, the piece of character that was, you know, being demonstrated of her.
Yeah. It, and I'm taking some heat in chat. I'm looking at it and I love it. So, Bob, you're so, I'm a defense attorney.
I love Bob's. I love your optic, Bob.
I Bob's
think
optic.
You make me think so hard. I love this optic all the time.
And that's all I can ask for. You know, because I can see people, I think, are misunderstanding. I think Corey did it. I think the verdict is correct. Like, that is what I am saying, is we cannot slip in this society, because what happens is there's cases where they don't get it right. And the process, have some respect for the Constitution. For all of you out there that are kind of like, Bob, you're so biased, or I don't like Bob because he's put aside the Corey thing. I think the jury got it right. I don't think that they deliberated. I think they got it right to the extent that I think that she was guilty. I think where the jury didn't do the work is what concerns me. I'm adamant about it.
Yeah.
I'm adamant that in every case in this country, because I just want people to put their own loved one in the situation of being a defendant in a case, and whether they did it or they didn't do it. But in a situation where they did do it, and the state was able to develop a theory, and you're confident that your loved one didn't do it, would you be satisfied with the jury going back for 2 hours and 40 minutes where they didn't really deliberate it?
Fair question.
You know, I mean, you have to look at it from your own personal perspective. You don't know Corey Richens, all you people in chat. And I think that's where she's where she belongs.
Yeah.
But in terms of holding the juries, and it's not just this jury, it's all juries. We have a responsibility as citizens in this country to go in there and do the work. And if that means just having, because it could have been as simple as, all right, we're going to go through it count by count and point out the evidence to me where you feel that they met that element of the charge. Like, so with like I'm still saying the only thing I don't think that they proved, it doesn't mean that I don't think she did it, because I do. I also, for the record, think she either tried to kill Josh or she was testing it out on Josh with whatever that hush puppy thing was.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I mean, I am dead set on that. So in terms of how we all feel about Corey, I think we're on the same, on the same boat in terms of, am I disappointed that I would like to see juries just go in there and just do the work? And if that says, okay, we got to take 8 hours to go through each and every count and just look through the evidence and talk through it, because conversation is everything.
Should there be a minimum? Should we have a minimum on jury deliberation?
I was thinking about
that. Look, you got to spend at least 8 hours on this, whatever it may be. The jury at a minimum at 8 hours has to come out of this thing, or it doesn't have to come out at 8 hours, but you got to spend at least eight. You got to, and you got to go through all this. You got to do the work, and whatever you come out with, you come out.
I think it's like, I don't hate that idea. You know,
every trial, same thing, no matter what. And they may sit, they still may have figured it out after 3 hours. And you're like, well, I'm going to, you know, play chess on my phone for the next five. But they have to spend the time. And I would imagine most of them would be doing that, at least giving it the shot, if that's the requirement.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to at least, in some way, shape, or form, it's going to encourage it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go, because I think that there are going to be cases where people are like, this is just overwhelming evidence. Mm-hmm. And look, circumstantial evidence is powerful.
Yeah.
Like every lawyer that's tried cases will tell you, direct evidence is not typically what is winning cases around the country. Mm-hmm. Because direct evidence is pretty rare. You know, eyewitness testimony is not reliable typically, mm-hmm. for a lot of reasons. You know, if you get something caught on video, there you go. That's probably your strongest direct evidence that you're going to get. But we live in a world where circumstantial evidence is what we build our cases around. So in no way, shape, or form am I suggesting that the circumstantial evidence in this case wasn't powerful, because it was.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but like for me, you still have to force the state to prove each and every element. And with that attempt murder, when we don't actually know what made Eric sick, mm-hmm. and we're just kind of guessing, and it fits with everything else that happens in retrospect.
Yeah.
I have a problem with it.
That could have been tainted ham for all we know, quite honestly, on that one.
Right. But you know, but the
pattern shows us probably not. But that's not we're doing it. We're not going for probably with a jury. We're going for beyond a reasonable doubt.
The one thing, there's a lot of things I love about Bob, but one of the greatest things is I've never known anyone, and I know there's others like you, Bob, and thank God there are, because you love the process of our law legal system so much that because of people like you and defense attorneys like you, there's less by mistake convictions. You know, you force the process to do the justice system, right? And you hold people accountable to actually do a good prosecution. You hold the investigators to do their job properly. And that actually keeps faith in the process and in the system rather than just being subjective all the time. So I like you, Chad. I love you loving it.
Yeah, I mean, equal importance is we don't want to have to redo these trials.
Yeah, that's a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, and you impact asked, on victims, too. Yeah.
If you ask the Richens family, and I'm talking about Eric's sisters and father, if you were to ask them, how would you feel about having to go through this trial again if this is overturned on appeal? They're not going to be happy about that prospect, because it's a grueling, emotional, nightmarish scenario where you're sitting in this courtroom hearing and reliving one of, if not the worst day of your life.
Yeah.
You know, when you're and it's like, so you want to, we have to get it right the first time.
Right.
And speaking of which,
you know, and I just see comments in here like guys like, oh, Bob thinks, I think all kinds of people are guilty. Like, you know, it's like, yeah. But it's that concept that people have about defense attorneys that we think all of our clients are innocent is number one, absurd. Mm-hmm. And it just shows a lack of knowledge about what the job really is. And like I take it upon myself when I kind of stepped away from practicing and somebody made a weird comment about the 12. I'm basing the, like this, I'm going to read Zen Dreaming. I'm running a little late on the live stream, but Bob bringing up 12 Angry Men in the jury, but he wants us to live in reality when he's basing his thought process in a movie. If Zen Dreaming, if you're taking from what I'm saying that I'm basing my thought process in a movie, I cannot help you.
You're missing the point. Yeah.
You're entirely missing the point. That is simply an example of an example that holds up all these many years later of what should take place in a jury room. And I'm basing that on my experience of trying cases.
And someone just put it right there too, Bob, you know, how we all collectively on the show feel about Richard Allen, and someone just mentioned Delphi and what you've done and are continuing doing because of that horrendous process and lack of due process on that. That's because they didn't do it right.
100%.
And you know, so,
but I think that they absolutely nailed it out of the park with Brian Koberg.
Yeah. Right.
I have no question that Lori Vallow is guilty. I have no question that Chad Daigle is guilty. Question that Brian Walsh is guilty. Like, those are cases. Like, there's
Stephen Stearns and Maddie Soto's case too. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
Speaking of it not being done right, that's where I want to go to next. But on all this, your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. Press subscribe wherever you're at so you don't miss any of our discussions like this about the many cases that we cover for you right here.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killer podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
By law, 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.